the idea that we each have main issues or challenges or struggles in our lives that impact us seems logical enough. But because we see ourselves as individual, we often think that our problems are unique to us. Nobody else in the world, nobody else out of 6.5 billion people have the same kind of issues or experiences that each of us have. That may not be true. But I do know that sometimes I can feel it myself and I hear it in other people who, when they find out that their situation is not unique to them, and in fact other people have had it, for instance, if you hear somebody say, oh yeah, I know so-and-so had that exact same experience, that somehow we become less than, that kind of diminishes our sense of individuality or uniqueness or originality. It's kind of like we want our struggles as a part of our definition of ourselves. My struggles, my problems are unique, which consequently make me unique. I'm not sure that that's true, because I'm starting to believe that there are common patterns. And let me just clarify. I don't mean common as in ordinary or insignificant or unimportant. I mean common in that they show up pretty frequently in the behaviors or experiences of humankind. And so that means they're common. We should be able to identify these patterns if they are occurring pretty frequently. And so today I want to start talking about three main issues. And what I think is that, well, this is what I thought at first, that these three main issues pertain to one person or maybe to a couple of people. But when I started thinking more deeply about these three main issues, I started to believe that what I was seeing is three common patterns that may have application over a far greater number of people. And so my plan is to speak about main issue number three today, and in the future speak about main issue number two and then main issue number one. And you'll have an opportunity to determine if these things have any kind of relevance at all to you. So let me just go through all three of those so you'll know what the future holds as well for these Sunday talks. Number three, and number one is the top of the pyramid, if you will. This is kind of like a countdown, David Letterman, right? Top 10 or top 20, whatever. However, we're sticking to three main issues. The number three issue is related to bonding and rejecting. Bonding and rejecting. Said another way, it's taking what we want and pushing away what we don't want. And this pattern shows up sometimes as a compulsive behavior. I gotta have it now. Gotta have it now. And followed by a subsequent pattern of, I need to push this away, I don't need it anymore, I don't want it anymore, and so now we try to put space between us and it. And this is what I'm going to talk about today. The number two main issue is our beliefs about taking action. And number one, I believe, is our fear of feedback from ourselves. Our fear of feedback from ourselves about what we have done and what we have done to others. So, now on today's topic, bonding and rejecting. Christ said in the book, Christ Returns, Speaks His Truth, that bonding and rejecting, number one, are the twin impulses that are essential for humankind's individualization. It is how our consciousnesses become individualized, so we think of ourselves as I or me, and I think of you as you. That, he says, this is a normal part of the process. It is essential and it is good. The second thing is saying about the same twin impulses of bonding and rejection, that these two impulses are responsible for all of mankind's suffering, illness, and struggles. Kind of interesting, right? This is good and it's necessary, and it really is a major problem with you folks. So, that's what we're going to be talking about today. getting things, if you can put that into quote, is really a pretty obvious behavior. Even in the smallest and youngest of infants, if we had mobiles hanging above their cribs, they would be looking at these things and it would gather their attention, and they would be reaching for them and trying to get a hold of them. And so this desire to make contact with things in our environment, we were doing very, very early in our lives. And this make contact, learn about them, get understanding, have this kind of energy exchange experience with these toys, these blocks, these whatever, is part of the deal. And so it's moving toward things and bonding with things, getting things that excite our interest, is part of our human condition. You'll also notice with infants that they will move toward some and allow people to move toward them when there's some undiscernible to us a kind of energy, and the kids, the infants, the babies are happy about that. But when they end up in the arms of being approached or touched by other people, now all of a sudden the unhappiness is pretty evident. They hold back. If they could, they would push away. They're expressing their displeasure by their squirming and crying and so on. That happens so early in our lives that we're like, oh, yeah, I think this really makes a lot of sense that this behavior goes on. If we were to look at children, and anybody who's ever been around an infant recognizes that they seem to want to bond with stuff by touching things. This is one of the reasons when kids start to crawl or stand up, a home needs to be childproof, because they're very inquisitive. They want to know, they want to understand, they want to interact with, they want to exchange energy with, they want contact with lots of different objects that interest them, and many, many things do interest a little child. We learn so fast as infants. We are information sponges. Some experts like Glenn Doman, who works with children to develop extraordinary talents, would say that the ability to learn in small children from infancy up to 5 or 6 years old is extraordinary. So they're looking to acquire energy, bond with, to take in energy of these experiences. Now, physically, a baby has limited processing capabilities. There's touch, and it seems pretty obvious to me and anybody else who's ever noticed a baby that at some point those blocks, those toys, whatever, are going to find their way into the baby's mouth, because that is a way a baby bonds. And it is designed into the system, and you could say, wow, the designer, capital D, really knew what he or she or it was doing when it made this natural impulse in this child seeking energy would want to use the mouth as a means of acquisition. Now, this is no real stretch of the imagination to say that babies bond with their mothers with their mouths when they are nursed. To have this need satisfied as an infant has got to be a good thing. So there, the baby is put on to nurse on his mother's chest or her mother's chest, and now can nurse. I am thinking there is no plastic bottle filled with factory-produced formula that is going to replace a warm breast accompanied by the rhythmic music of that mother's heart. There's got to be an amazing amount of good stuff that is being experienced by this baby. It is bonding. It is successfully bonding. And the mother is bonding to the baby. That has got to be a win-win situation that shapes great things for that baby's life. And, frankly, I would think for the mother as well, knowing that she has been this conduit of this loving energy, not just mother's milk, that substance, which, of course, is documented as having tremendous physiological value, but the energy of a mother doing that for and to a baby has got to be a great thing all the way around. Some babies reject the breast. Now, Jesus, talking about the truth of existence, says that growth, along with nutrition and nourishment, are two of the main factors of the nine that he lists in the truth of existence. They're designed in there. It's, in my language now, I'll call it, it's a promise, if you will, of divine consciousness, God, to us as living beings. Growth, nutrition, and nourishment are promised to us. Now, why would a baby reject the mother's breast? Well, clearly that question is more rhetorical, simply because it could be debated for years and years by all sorts of experts, and I don't consider myself to be one. But suffice it to say that the baby has learned how to reject very early in its life, or it wouldn't do it. It doesn't sing and it doesn't cook pancakes, so it hasn't learned that, either of those activities yet, but it certainly has learned how to reject. And so you question, if it learned that, was it taught that vibration of rejection? Did it come from into this physical life with this idea and this vibration and this knowingness of rejection? Was it taught this by people in its early development, that is, from conception up to the first few days of its life? And is it rejecting the rejectors? And is this a rejecting of its own life? Is it rejecting its own existence? Is it some sort of behavior? And this is a thing that has come up under hypnosis in some of the books that I've studied, that people are like, do over, wait, I don't really want to be born, you know, I think I made a mistake choosing this family and that sort of thing. In the book by Dr. Modi, M-O-D-I, first initial S, she's a psychiatrist out of West Virginia that wrote Remarkable Healings. This I think I made a mistake kind of thing, occurred very frequently in a lot of her hypnosis work with patients. So I think that's probably not an unfamiliar kind of experience. As a parent, I sure noticed that my children and other people's children tend to bond to a particular blanket. And I can even recall the kind that I bonded to as a little child with that satin fringe around it, a nice light blanket, but with a satin fringe. That texture, that feeling is so wonderful for so many of us. Or a stuffed animal. I don't recall personally a stuffed animal, but I certainly see it with children and my own, that when it came time to say, okay, you need to take a nap, or it's time for you to go to sleep at night, that it's like, hello, I need to have my blanket, I need to have my stuffed toy. They need to be able to bond to these, even though they're individuals early in their experiences. They haven't really come to terms with that, I think. And so they're looking for a sense of belongingness, of connectedness, of togetherness, and those blankets and stuffed toys that give them a sense of safety are the ones that are absolute requirements before a nap or nighttime is going to be accepted. When the child, shortly after, I don't know what year this would occur, the second year or maybe even earlier, depending on a child, I suppose, is they recognize that they are a small individual in a world of large individuals. And when the conversation turns to, you know, the so big, remember that as a parent or a child? So big. Everything is about size. Big, big, big. He's big, 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 big. All of a sudden, that child, even at a very early age, can realize, you know what? You know what? This is all about being big. I want to be big. I want to be big. So a lot of children really recognize that being big is the alternative, not only to being small, but it is the gateway to power, control, influence, safety, the things they want, lessened pain, and so on. So it's like, oh, well, I got to be big. I, you know, small people, not too good. Weak, disempowered at the beck and call of other people, controlled by other people, I really do want to be big. And then if you grew up in a family like mine where tallness was a normal trait, from the earliest days we start measuring the children in the family and make marks on a door jamb, for instance, okay, you're this tall at this on this date, and then, you know, some months later you're this tall at this date, and so on. Well, I was in a family of seven children. My mother was 5'10", and she had brothers who were 6'4" and 6'5", so height was a fairly frequent conversation. I think my mother may have been just slightly taller than my father, so might have made him feel not so good as compared to her, but nonetheless, it was a main topic. And with an older brother, we were always seeing who could jump the highest, touch the highest up on the wall, and can you reach the ceiling, and fingerprints were on ceilings, and all about trying to be bigger, trying to be bigger, trying to be bigger. And so this idea of being bigger really drives a lot of our behavior. And early on, we would have noticed some pain in our experiences that rejecting is a second tool. It's a second aspect of this tool of control. We bond if people behave a certain way, and we reject them if they don't behave in a certain way. We experience that being on the end of being rejected, and it's like, ow. And then all of a sudden, that doesn't feel all that good to us. And we recognize this. We'll be nice to somebody who behaves the way we want. That's bonding. And we'll be not as nice to somebody who is behaving in a way that we disapprove of. That's rejecting. This is how a lot of things are played out for us. Now, bonding, under normal circumstances, with normal people, is consensual, right? There are two people involved in whatever it is. Let's go roller skating. If two people are involved in this and they both have a chance to say yes if they wish, that's a different thing. That's a win-win that arises from that yes-yes kind of situation. And you can imagine that in that scenario, there is a respect for not only the other person's individuality, but that other person has a respect for your individuality. And so that kind of a scenario, yes, yes, win-win, is very pleasant sort of an experience. Rejection, on the other hand, is the idea that we either withdraw love, we pull back our energy, we separate ourselves, we cut off that flow of energy, or we don't offer it in the first place. We just never open the door to that other person because of some perceived lack of proper behavior on their part. They don't look the way we want them to look. They don't think the way we want them to think. They don't feel the way we want them to feel. They don't act the way we want them to act. And so this rejecting, this pushing them away, separating us from them or them from us, is what we learn how to do. Oftentimes, it's meant to be hurtful. Now, you know, the idea that, quotes, children can be cruel is the recognition that children in their rejection are very hurtful. Now, do they really perceive how hurtful they are? I think not. But are they hurtful? I think so. And so kids can be cruel, but that's because they have not yet learned compassion. They have not been on the receiving end of what they're delivering, so they're only delivering it, and it doesn't hurt me to be unkind or really mean-spirited to that other person. But as we go through life, then all of a sudden that starts to change, and we start to experience that. Sometimes people think that rejection is just a change of heart. And what was once wanted is no longer wanted. I don't think I agree with that. Because that phrase, change of heart, is probably inaccurate. frankly, I don't think that hearts are fickle or whimsical. If the heart was engaged in a relationship in the first place, to be able to disconnect it or change so quickly, I think would be not quite so possible. I think heart connections are very enduring. So the sentence I could have used would be, it is often a change of whim, and what was once wanted is no longer wanted. And so we're whimsical, we're fickle, we're quick to want things. Well, I want this, I want that, I want this, I want that. And there's nothing wrong with that as long as we recognize that that's exactly what's going on. And then we would understand it. And if we could perceive that there's an impact on someone or something else with this whimsical behavior, then all of a sudden we may put our foot on the brake a little bit to slow down, because these negative impacts will come to us. And by that I mean that I feel as though one of the most important aspects of bonding and rejection is that while we think we're bonding with X or we're rejecting Y, whether they're people or concepts or activities or situations or you name it, the fact is we are really bonding and rejecting with ourselves. These bonding and rejection offering energies impact us. It's as if we're planting seeds in the garden of our own lives. We're not just doing stuff to other people. We're not just bonding with them or rejecting them. We're doing this to ourselves. We're planting seeds in the garden of our own lives. And as a result of that, what we're going to harvest, hello, are going to be exactly the kind of seeds that we've planted. And so if we become mindful gardeners, if we are aware of what it is we're doing when we offer energy in these two forms, and they're standard forms, I mean, we're going to do it, and it's okay to do it. It's part of life. But if we can be skillful at it, it's not like Demolition Derby, where we crash into things and leave a trail of destruction behind us. It doesn't need to be that way. We can be mindful, and we can grow the highest quality life that we can imagine when we play this game mindfully. Do we bond in order to fulfill our needs? Do we bond to be bigger, to have more influence, more power, more control? I think the answer is, fairly lengthy, is if we believe that our lives will be best they can be by bonding this way, in all of these ways, getting more power, getting more control, getting more money, getting more influence, dominating other people. If we believe that, then we are going to bond that way. The answer is yes. Lots of bonding is initiated by the processing of visual information. Love at first sight. Love at first sight is that idea. Wow, I looked at that person, and it was love at first sight. It's like judging a book by its cover. We wouldn't brag about judging, oh, I judged a book by its cover. We wouldn't brag about that, because we've already made decisions, or certainly this is other people, is that, the rule is don't judge a book by its cover. There's more to a book than just its cover. Of course there is. On the other hand, there's very little doubt that a very attractive cover, an interesting cover, is going to cause people to direct their attention to that book or person. We all recognize this idea that physical beauty is attractive. Very attractive. This has been tested across all cultures on the planet in one form or another. And physical beauty has certain standards to it, symmetry and so on, and people go in that direction. They're attracted by physical beauty. What we do with the book and its cover, or physical beauty, the love at first sight, is we give meaning to those two objects, the book or the person. We give meaning to them. and was like, oh, I just gave meaning to that book, and I feel good about that book. I feel good about bonding to that book, my relationship with that book, and my relationship with that person. Oh, I feel good as I play with it in my own imagination, even though I could be, you know, feet, yards, miles, kilometers apart from either one of those things. As we play with it in our imaginations, we feel good about ourselves, and we go, oh, you know what? If I could have that book or that person, if I could acquire their energy, if I could bond more intimately, if I could open the pages, or if I could be closer to this in an intimate relationship, this would support my view of my needs being fulfilled. If that were happening, we would continue to try to bond with this person. What happens later on is when another's physicality or emotional expressions, the way they express their feelings or not, and the way they think or not, all of a sudden it's like, you know what, I'm starting to notice these discrepancies that before I attached a whole set of meanings to this scenario, and now not. Now I'm starting to see the flaws, and I'm starting to stack up evidence or justification for the rejecting process. Years ago, I lived in Manhattan. Manhattan was a fantastic city, and it is even today. I noticed when I first moved into Manhattan in 1980, I loved pretty much everything about it. If I had to say percentage-wise, I love 99% of everything that I noticed in Manhattan. And it was fantastic. 11.5 years later, when I was ready to move from Manhattan to San Diego, I noticed that if I were to do an assessment of my feelings about Manhattan, I was pretty much rejecting 99% of everything I saw about Manhattan. At that time, 1992, I attributed it to Manhattan changing. Oh, Manhattan changed. It went from really, really, really excellent to really, really, really not excellent. And that's why I went from bonding to rejecting. In retrospect, I know that is absolutely not true. What happened is I stopped attending to bonding. I started to notice the flaws, and I gave them my attention. And then I gave him more attention, and it attracted more things for me to be bothered by, annoyed by, things that I felt were nuisances or problems. It was my lack of understanding of what I was doing with my attention and my own focus. I blamed it on Manhattan. It wasn't Manhattan at all. It was me. It was not recognizing that bonding is a continual process. And it's very easy to fall into rejection, to see superficial things as being problematic, while as the city itself was unbelievably fantastic and is today, and it has been every day in between, with the possible exception of 9/11. And then you saw a great opportunity for people to display fantastic behaviors on that day. So every day it's been fantastic. We control how we bond and how we reject. In terms of our relations with people, our relationships say, you know what? I want to cause a bonding reaction in others. That is, I want them to like me. I want them to behave in a way that I can predict and control, and that makes me feel good. It makes me feel safe. It helps my needs be fulfilled. And I also want to avoid causing rejection reactions in other people. So I'm walking on, is it a tightrope? Is it a boulevard? Is it a narrow path? Is it a small sidewalk? I think it depends on us individually based upon our early family of origin experiences and how much bonding, how much rejecting we experience. So we kind of take that as a world view. Oh, the world is a really rejecting place. In which case, we're going to go out there and display one of a handful of behaviors in an effort to get our needs met and to survive, and that would be to be so good that nobody would want to reject us, be so helpful, to be so valuable. Or we try to be so controlling that we wouldn't allow them. We get the world in a headlock so it can't reject us. And then we can be preemptively rejecting. Hi, I reject you. It's like, oh, we didn't even get to meet. I know, but it saves me the trouble and the shock of waiting for you to reject me. Let me do it first. And withdrawal and so on. We have these behaviors that are going on for us all based upon this idea of desiring bonding and desiring to avoid being rejected. And if we look at that, we take our individual viewpoint, the way I see the world is the way the world is. I don't think so. But nonetheless, as individuals, we tend to believe that idea. My view is the view as compared to, no, I have a view that's one of 6.5 billion of the views, one of 6.5 billion. That's not the majority. That's one view. And so this idea that people should behave according to our values, the way we see things, the way we understand stuff, and if they don't, we reject them. I refer to this periodically, that I believe there are multiple laws that should be obeyed, law of gravity, law of attraction, and slower traffic, move right. On a highway, slower traffic in the left lane to me is a gross violation of what should be one of the standard behaviors in civilized societies. I have elevated it to one of the top 3 or 4 or 5. It's like, hello, how goofy is that? Nonetheless, I play with this idea, and I think it's funny on the one hand and weird on the other, is, yeah, that's important, because so many people get upset, they get angered, they get real rejecting because somebody is going 70 in the left lane of a highway that's got a speed limit of 70 miles per hour. Like, slower traffic, move right. Guys, at the top limit of the, quotes, law, end quotes, but he still should move right. He should move right. And we go through all kinds of gyrations and conversations in the car about this guy and our desire to reject him for misbehaving, for not following one of our rules. And if you follow one of our rules, we go like, oh, I like that guy. I want to bond. He's great. He's following the same rule that I do. Yeah, that's great. That's great. But when we do that, we really set ourselves up for a lot of behaviors, a lot of information processing that is disturbing to our peace. We literally create it for ourselves. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to know that for each of us, nobody else on the planet has formed the same viewpoints, the same opinions, has the same take on any situation in great detail, simply because nobody's had our same experiences, been raised by the same families at the same time, with the same inputs, had the same thoughts, has all of that stuff. We're all different. We all see life differently. And for us to try to impose our view of life, here's a view of life, follow this and everything will be fine. Like, whoa, I think, isn't that part of what that individual is supposed to be doing, developing his or her own viewpoint on what life is and how to enjoy it and how to fulfill purposes? Oh, yeah, I just wanted to give them rules on how to do it. It's a real problem. It's a real problem trying to control other people's behavior and using and believing that other people's behavior is what makes us happy or unhappy. That's like taking our power, handing it over to a stranger, or maybe not a stranger, and say, here, you control my happiness. Now, please be careful with it. Please behave accordingly, and I want to be happy. It's like, if you wanted to be happy, why would you give me your happiness? Give it to me to be in control of. I have my own needs. I have my own needs and interests. You keep your happiness, I'll keep mine. You be in charge of your happiness, I'll be in charge of mine. Wow. And so one of the goals I've established as a result of Christ's letters is this idea of letting go of judging other people's thoughts and emotions and behaviors as if they were the main ingredients in my happiness. That's false. That's false. Like, they're playing a game they're playing. Hello. They're not playing my game. My game is to maximize the joy and the value that I get out of life and that I put into life. And to understand and experience my Creator as well as I can. That's what they're doing. That's what all of us are doing. It's like, oh, okay. So it's a solitary game. It's kind of like solitaire. I don't mind if you cheat at solitaire. It's a solitary game. But for those of us who have had inputs of rejecting, I'm so good at rejecting. I'm so good at rejecting. And that's the direction we go in. And offering rejection is to plant seeds of rejection. And any farmer would say, I can predict what your crop is going to be. And I don't think that's really what you have in mind. It can only be rejection. And the fact is that we use these as weapons, the rejection as a goad, a cattle prod, or a needle to try to get other people to do the things that we want. Wow, has that ever been around a long, long time? As early as mankind, if not earlier, if you were to look at some, say, National Geographic or Discovery or History Channel, and they're showing animal packs like wolves, you can go, yeah, okay. I think I'm seeing here bonding and rejecting, and I'm seeing domination and submission as a way to control the structure of that pack. That pack is a conglomeration of beings designed for the survival of that group. Its likelihood of survival is a lot better if they're a pack of 12 or so, as compared to 12 individual wolves out on their own trying to make do in the forest. If we were to go back in time, it seems kind of inevitable to me that the twin impulses of bonding and rejection are in our earliest written history in the Western culture. We would assign these two traits, right, to the unseen. It was like, yeah. We're trying to explain why some good things happen to us and why some bad things. Well, this good thing, this fortuitous thing, this fortunate occurrence was benevolent, and this bad thing, this earthquake, this flood, this whatever, was a negative being expressed to us. We would have attributed these traits to the unseen. And certainly, in the Bible, early on, it's like, okay, so there we got a God that's creating the world. It's like, create this, it's good. Create this, it's good. Create this, it's good. Create this, it's good. And wow, that's a loving God. That's a real creative God. That's a really God with a lot of initiative, a lot of insight. Except when it comes time for looking at the two people in the Garden of Eden that break the rules, that misbehave. Then it's rejection city. Get out of the garden. You guys are in big trouble now. And that's when the rejecting started. You go, wow. Bonding and rejection. A loving God, a wrathful God. A kind and thoughtful God to a punitive God. Based upon actions. Like, God is loving, according to this model, when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. When you're doing what God wants, God is going to be loving. When you're doing what God doesn't want, look out. He is going to be really unhappy. Going to reject you if you behave badly. If you obey His rules, you're in good shape. If you disobey His rule, you're in bad shape. That has been around and drummed into us in way, way before Christ was born. Way before. And this, in my opinion, superstitious outlook of, bad things are going to fall out of the sky and hit me if I don't obey some... Tell me again what the rule was. Right, and a lot of rule interpreters or rule makers would hand me that in written form on papyrus or in clay tablets or some other form. It's like, wow. So what is the ultimate representation of God's bonding and rejecting? heaven and hell. That's what the promise was, according to so much of what we're taught via Christianity, or I suppose Judaism, is heaven or hell. That strategy, that godlike strategy of punishment or kindness, is employed by little children and the oldest senior citizens. If you turn around and watch a couple of little children play, and maybe they come across some sort of conflict as to who's going to grab which toy, all of a sudden you could see some sulking or pouting or making others wrong. And not just children. Not just children. I've seen 80-year-old men behave like 4-year-old boys. It's like, wow, that's weird. That's amazing. That pouting and sulking and having a temper tantrum, that is really a way to try to get other people to behave the way we want. That's what a temper tantrum is. Like, woo. When we withdraw our energy from people we can't get to behave according to our standards, we withdraw our energy. We threaten people with complete rejection, and then we'll actually then use bonding against their will in order to take control of them. Look at this. If you were to turn around and recognize that somebody just got arrested, we grab them. We grab them. We're bonding with them. That's not what an innocent person or a criminal, for that matter, would want to occur, this bonding. So they're arrested, they're tried in a court of law in the U.S. sometimes, and then they're convicted, and then they're imprisoned. We take charge of all the bonding, and we take charge of all the rejecting, because we have determined, according to the way we've structured society, that they violated the rules of bonding. If they bonded in a non-consensual way, right, they robbed somebody, they didn't exchange money with them, or they raped somebody, or they mugged somebody, that's non-consensual. That's not yes, yes, that's yes, no, and that's bad news. Or they rejected somebody, they hurt somebody else. We would deem that to be against our rules, and we take total charge of them. Those behaviors get started in a very, very early age. Criminal behaviors of bonding and rejecting get started at a very early age. A couple of years ago, working on a veterans event called a Stand Down in Virginia, was an effort to induce veterans to come out of the woods because it was going to become wintertime, and try to get them back into the system. These are people that so felt rejected by society and were so rejecting of society based upon the trauma of their experiences in either Vietnam, even some were career veterans, but in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so these people were being induced, we were seeking to bond with them to help them come back into the Veterans Administration system to get health care and dental care and food and clothing and a haircut and a shave, and maybe to be able to, on an energetic level, to handle some of their traumatic experiences, so they were more fully capable of making decisions on a mindful basis about what they wanted to bond to and what they wanted to reject, as compared to just needing to run from humankind to try to be safe or to try to protect humankind from themselves after their military experiences. That attempt to bring those people in and to help them really is the way to recognize that that approach is what has to happen. While I was at that event in Virginia, I was speaking with somebody else who was a social worker and had worked as a social worker in a penitentiary, and we got to talking about children and experiences and trauma and so on, and he mentioned that 80% of the men that were imprisoned for violent crimes had been sexually abused as boys or young men. They were bonded with improperly, and because of that, were so self-rejecting, this is my language today, so self-rejecting, and that self-rejection overflowed onto other people. So instead of bonding in normal sense with other people, being cruel and unkind and vicious to other people was the way they expressed this toxicity that they were filled with from the abuse that they had experienced earlier in their own lives. Now, it seems expedient to put these people in jail, but it would have been far more expedient to have healed that situation when those children experienced it, and even better if it were prevented in the first case and it never took place at all. If I were to look at a toy, and I'm thinking of a yo-yo, and I could also look at a seesaw, which I'll mention in a minute, but a yo-yo is a little toy, usually for children, that is a wooden device attached to string, and you tie the string around a finger. And the yo-yo is fun in that you can push or throw the yo-yo away from you, and when it gets to the end of the string, with a motion of your hand, you can cause it to come back to you by rolling up the string. So you can look at it and say, oh, that's interesting. Bonding as it's in my hand, and then rejecting as I push it away, and then I pull it back. I want it to come back to my hand, and then back and forth, back and forth. It is the fun of that motion, this control over that experience, is so intriguing about this toy. You know, if you handed somebody a yo-yo and say, here, you can just hold it in your hand, and it's fun just to hold it. You know, just hold it in your hand, and when you hold it in that hand for a while and that's boring, you can move it to the other hand and hold it that way. It was like, that toy would not be in use very often for very long. It is the motion. It is controlling this energy by our own energy is what is so fun about that. And if you were to look at a seesaw and offer children an opportunity to climb up on a seesaw, and then you make the seesaw fixed so it wouldn't move, it wouldn't go up and down, those kids would be on the seesaw for, 10 seconds or so? And like, okay, I'm done. Let me off. And it is the up and down of the energy. It is the motion. It is this to and fro, the back and forth that we find so engaging in all kinds of games, solitary games as well as in team sports like football or basketball, you name it. It's about this whole process. This is what we really like, this motion. And it is trying to understand how to play the game of bonding and rejecting so it ends up being a win-win as compared to being a win-lose. If we're going to do it with bonding and rejecting, if you will, we're going to play the game of human life with Mother Earth. Now, clearly, you can look around and say, oh, a lot of not nice things are going on with Mother Earth. And because people oftentimes go, we don't care about Mother Earth. It's not really a thing that we have to look out for. It's not consensual. We don't have to ask for her yes. We can just do what we want. We're in total control of the bonding and rejection. She has nothing at all to say about it. Well, I happen to be standing in a hotel room right as I'm talking now in Cancun, Mexico, where this previous week ended yesterday, actually, or Friday, a conference on global warming. Mother Earth is speaking back. Mother Earth is responding to our inputs, and global warming is one of those ways. Now, a lot of people want to dispute that, but people who were washed away in floods this past year would probably go, something's going on. The excessive snowfall, something's going on for all that humidity to be in the air that now falls in the wintertime as snow. Something is going on, yeah. Something is going on. I think you can really look at this stuff, and it's kind of interesting to be able to see that our compulsive or impulsive wanting is promoted by advertising, consume, consume, consume. Well, on the one hand, all this consumption creates a lot of jobs in factories and other places like that. But that's kind of a limited imagination that says that's the only way for a job to be created. Frankly, I think we're missing a bet there. I think it would be so much easier if we would say the growth industry is the growth industry, not the death industry. The death industry right now is the growth industry. It doesn't need to be that way. We can make the growth industry, that is, ways for us to grow, which is the number one item in the truth of existence, growth. And growing spiritually and mentally, emotionally and physically, being healthy. We don't need all these diseases. We don't need all these drugs. We don't need all these chemicals. We don't need all these medical processes. There is a different way we could do this. And rather than falling for the advertising that triggers a knee-jerk reaction, I gotta have that. And you certainly know this time of the year, that advertising that is bombarding children early on Saturday mornings, right, the cartoon times, if you will, or I guess after school, all that advertising is designed to cause those children to need to bond with these toys. So instead of the kid getting out a credit card or a checkbook or going online and ordering this stuff, they have to turn around and hammer their parents. I gotta have this. I gotta have this. Please, please. I gotta have this. I gotta have this toy. All my friends are gonna have this toy, and I don't want to be the one without it because I will be rejected. And we think we gotta have this to keep up with the Joneses. Why do we have to keep up with the Joneses? Because we'll be less than the Joneses, we'll be rejected by our peers. That's a trap. We don't need to fall for that. If we could understand what these signals are targeted at, I mean, we're being bombarded with these advertising slogans and the music and the imagery and so on. It's not designed for us. It's designed to trigger this impulsive, compulsive bonding with whatever product or pharmaceutical that is being advertised. That's really what it's designed for. It's not designed for our good. It's designed for the good of the people who believe that selling more stuff to us will increase their power, their influence, their wealth, their control over us. They are the ones. If we understood that the control is from the outside, you know, I'll call them bosses or spouses or advertisers or authority figures or you name it. You can add teachers and church people, whoever you want. All of them rely on us not really understanding what it is we want or why we really want things. They just want us to hear that urge, I want this, and react to it. And then when we come to the rejecting phase, we discard it. We recycle it, perhaps. In the U.S., it ends up in a landfill. But if we listened when they tell us, yeah, this is what you want, this is what you want, this is what you want, and you don't even need to know why you want it, we'll show you an image of a smiling guy walking in the office on Monday, and which you'll interpret, because this is a Viagra or a Cialis ad, you know that he's been pleasured physically. That's what you want. That's what you want. I'm not so sure. Perhaps there are good things about being a sheep in the flock, because there's got to be an absence of pressure about making difficult decisions. You know, follow the leader. You don't have to make decisions. Belonging to the group, there's a real benefit there. What should we do? Well, that's easier than standing on your own two feet, making your own, oh, wow, if I make my own decision, I can really set myself up to be bonded with if I'm fortunate, or rejected if I'm making the wrong decision. Oh, I better go along with the flock or the herd or the mob. Yeah. When those mobs or flocks or herds are tightly packed on their way to be manipulated and slaughtered, it seems comforting because you can lean against the other sheep because you're packed so tightly. and you can hide there for support or anonymity. There's a real trouble there, though. It limits what one can create, what one can experience. Since these decisions are controlled by other people and not by us, we're settling for some other source to fulfill our needs instead of going to the one true source. I would say God. Why do I want it now? Time is usually a factor in a lot of stuff. You hear it in ads all the time. Sale, limited time only, limited quantity only. People are definitely trying to trigger our sense of scarcity and our fear of not having whatever it is they're peddling. And worse than that for us is, what am I going to say to myself or others when I don't buy this newest gadget, this newest toy, this newest whatever it is that's being marketed? Oh, I have to put up with my regret, my guilt, my this, my that. Ooh-wee. That's a challenge. But when this stuff is marketed to us, and we thought in terms of bonding and rejecting, well, hold on a second. Let me put the foot on the brake. Let me ask myself a couple of questions. What are my physical reasons for wanting it now? What are my emotional reasons for wanting it now? What are my mental reasons for wanting it now? And what are the spiritual reasons for me wanting this now? If we would just be self-referential, REF, and I think being self-reverential and connecting to God is the same as being self-reverential, REV. The whole reverence for our ability to access divine consciousness in our decision-making all of a sudden gives us access to a higher level of thinking, mindfulness, and chances are we're going to be really pleased with the outcomes of these decisions. We could also ask us, what emotional states am I in right now when I want this thing? Where am I? Shame, apathy, grief, fear, lust, anger, pride, courageousness, acceptance, and peace? Because I know that depending on which rung of that ladder I happen to be on, my view of whatever it is I'm looking at is going to be different. And if I'm doing this from lust, craving, that's an addictive sort of place. That's like the object is controlling us. We're not controlling our feelings about it. So if you can identify that, it's like, I see what's going on. What physical, emotional, mental, or social needs are being activated by this advertising, by the appearance of this object on the screen of my attention, and are seeking fulfillment? What's going on there? What of my needs, survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity, the need to be right, the need to look good or get approval, which of those needs are being activated that I am in a knee-jerk reaction fashion seeking to satisfy? I'm being controlled like a yo-yo on a string, like a marionette on a string, to these kind of needs. And if it's not mindful and it's not heart-connected, I've given away a huge amount of power. And I think these same questions could be used when we get to the point where we're thinking in terms of rejecting. Why do I need to push it away now? What are the physical reasons for me pushing it away? What are the emotional reasons for me pushing it away? What are the mental reasons for pushing it away? What are the spiritual reasons for me pushing it away? And what emotional state am I in now that I want to push it away? What needs of survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity, the need to be right, the need to look good or get approval, are seeking fulfillment. What's getting triggered? What is being threatened that I need to act now? And I could look at the physical, emotional, mental, and social needs that I think are being threatened as well, that cause me to want to reject. If we can gain awareness of our bonding and our rejecting, we're going to be so much better off playing the game of life, because we can actually use our own highest capabilities of thinking, feeling, before we act, and we can also access God, we can ask for help, we can connect to divine consciousness. That's really what we want to do. If we looked at an addict, a drug addict, for example, who has given up their power to choose, somebody with an obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, or somebody who's a holic, workaholic, alcoholic, gambleaholic, you name it. It's the same as somebody who is reactive. They give their power of cause over to someone or something else, and then they take the role of an effect, the reactor, the marionette at the end of the string. That's not what we want. The truth of existence says that growth, nutrition and nourishment, healing, protection, fulfillment of needs, work, survival, rhythm, and spiritual law and order exist for our benefit. And all of them, all of those characteristics and attributes are available to us always from God, from divine consciousness, from however you name that creative source. Grabbing greedily and rejecting angrily are completely unnecessary and counter to our goal of happiness and understanding and experiencing our Creator. It is completely in the opposite direction that we want to go. And as we know what we're doing with regard to bonding and rejection, we would have turned this third major issue into a tremendous stepping stone on our way to the lives that we want to create. I would like to end this service with a prayer. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know that it is your will that we should be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that it is our eventual purpose to express you. As we speak to you, we know that you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. That prayer is a variation, pluralized variation, of the prayer in letter 8 of Christ Returns Speaks His Truth, which I highly recommend. It is so. Thank you. Amen.